And now we come to a lecture of the, not a lecture, no, this is actually an article written by Rudolf Steiner on the 23rd of 23rd of September, 1890, entitled The Atomistic and Its Refutation. Rudolf Steiner starts by saying, first, we want to make present to ourselves the today's general teaching about sense perception, and then upon the contradictions in it, and to point to a viewpoint which is in accordance with an idealistic worldview. Today's natural science considers that the whole world space is filled with an infinitely thin substance called, which it calls the ether. This substance consists out of pure, infinitely small parts, the ether atoms. This ether is not only there present where no bodies are, but are also present in the pores which exist in the bodies. Physics, the physicist, represents to himself that each single body consists out of an infinite number of small, immeasurable, small parts, the atoms. These atoms are not placed adjacent to each other, but are separated by small interspaces. These atoms again unite themselves to greater structures, larger structures, the molecules, which are still not yet perceptible for the eye. Only insofar as an infinite number of many molecules group themselves together, there arises that which we with our senses can perceive as bodies. First we want to explain with an example this type of way of thinking about it. There exists in nature a gas which we call hydrogen, and another gas which we call oxygen. Now hydrogen consists out of non-measurable small atoms of hydrogen, and oxygen likewise consists of atoms of oxygen. Now we want to indicate the atoms of hydrogen with red small circles and the atoms of oxygen with blue small circles. And so according to that, the physicists would represent to himself a definite quantity of hydrogen as in our diagram 1, and a definite quantity of oxygen as in diagram 2. In the diagram 1 you have a small number of small red circles clumped together, and in diagram 2 you have a small number of blue circles clumped together. Now we are now in a position to, through certain special processes which at the present moment do not interest us, but through special processes we are able to place the hydrogen to the oxygen in such a connection that in each atom of hydrogen there unlagert, that attaches to itself an atom of oxygen, so that out of that a compound substance must arise, which we shall represent in the following diagram 3. Diagram 3 he places a small blue circle to the side of a small red circle, and round them both of them he puts a dotted larger circle to include them both. Now here we build for each atom of hydrogen together with an atom of oxygen, we build a totality. And this totality, consisting out of two atoms, is still not perceptible. It's a small structure which we call molecule. However, the substance of this molecule, which consists of each atom of hydrogen with an atom of oxygen, is called water. Here I'd like to make a comment. I believe Rudolf Steiner has made a very serious mistake here. Because every person knows elementary sense. I can't understand where he went wrong or where I'm wrong. But the fact is that a molecule of water is H2O, consists of two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen. So what he should have done is to put, in that larger dotted circle within that, he should have taken two small red circles representing two atoms of hydrogen, and one blue circle dot representing one atom of oxygen. So it seems to me that Rudolf Steiner has made a very serious mistake here. This is not a lecture. This is actually a thesis he wrote. It's very difficult for me to believe that Rudolf Steiner could have done this, but he did it. I don't know where okay? He clearly states in his article that every molecule of water consists of one atom of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen. And then he continues, it can also say that a molecule can be composed out of three different atoms, or four different atoms, or five different atoms. Thus, for example, a molecule of alcohol consists of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. I might add here, this is Rick Mansell speaking, the actual formula for alcohol is C2H5OH. It means one molecule of alcohol, which is ethyl alcohol, contains two atoms of carbon, six atoms of hydrogen, and one atom of oxygen. Now Rudolf Steiner continues, at the same time we see out of this that modern physics represents to itself every body, liquid, solid, or aeroform bodies consisting of parts, and between them you have empty space portions called pores. Into these pores there penetrate the ether atoms which fill out the whole world space, so that if we represent the ether atoms as points, so we have to represent a body as in Fig 4. Fig 4, you have molecules represented by different colored small circles, and then in the interspaces between the molecules he puts just plain points to represent the ether. The red and blue small circles are atomic bodies, and the black points are ether atoms. Now we have to represent to ourselves that the bodies, as well as the ether atoms, are in a state of continuous motion. And this motion is a schwingende, a swinging, an oscillating motion. One must conceive that every atom, as well as the atom of the body, as well as an atom of ether, pendulates back and forth like the pendulum of a watch, of a clock. Now we have to imagine at A, a body whose molecule is in ceaseless motion. This motion is carries itself over to the ether atoms in the pores, and from there onto the ether outside. You have this motion. It transfers itself to the ether atoms in the pores, and from there to the ether outside the body to B, and from B, to example, to C, and so on. Let us assume that at point D there is a sense organ, for example, the eye. So the vibrations of the ether come onto the, impinge upon the eye, and through the eye, right to the nerve N. And then, from the nerve N, through the nerve conducting L, right into the brain G. Now let us assume, for example, that the body A is in such a motion that the molecule oscillates 461 billion times in a second. Then also, every ether molecule will oscillate 461 billion times in a second. It oscillates back and forth and impinges 461 billion times onto the site nerve N. The nerve, the conducting nerve L, carries over, transfers these 461 billion oscillations to the brain, and here we have a sensation. In this case, hochrot, bright red or crimson. And so the physicist says the following: while I represent to myself crimson, there occurs in the external world nothing further than that the molecules carry out 461 billion oscillations in a second. Now, if instead of having 461 billion oscillations, they had 760 billions, then I would perceive violet. If there were 548 billion oscillations, then I would perceive yellow, and so on. So as to say that every color sensation corresponds in the external world to a quite definite motion. It's much more simpler in the case of the sensation of sound. Here, the body molecules also oscillate. However, the medium by which these oscillations are carried on to our ear is not the ether, but the air. If, for example, the molecule of a body executes 148 oscillations in 1 second, and the air continues, transplants this 140 oscillations per second to our ear, then we perceive the sound D. If it is 371 oscillations in the second, then it is F sharp sound. Thus we see the aspect to which this whole teaching wants to point. Everything which we perceive in the world with the senses, colors, sounds, etc., is supposed not to really exist, but only to appear within our brain when in the external world definite forms of oscillating movement are present. If I perceive heat, so this is there only because the ether around me is in movement, and the ether atoms impinge upon my skin nerves. When I perceive light, it's because the same ether atoms approach my sense nerves. Hence, says the modern physicist, there exists in reality nothing other than oscillating, self-moving atoms. All the rest is only a creation of my brain, which forms this whenever it is contacted by motion in the external world. Now, I don't believe it's necessary for me to point out the comfortlessness of such a worldview. The person who might not be filled by the most sad ideas if, when, for example, Hugo Magnus calls out something like this, expresses something like this. Hugo Magnus, who has been captured in this direction, says something like this. He quotes, "This ether movement is the single thing which is, in a real and truly objective manner, present of color. Only in the human body, in the brain, these ether movements are transformed to images, ideas, vorstellungen, mental concepts, which we ordinarily indicate as red, yellow, green, etc. Thus, according to that, we have to say the world in itself is absolutely colorless. Only through the fact that the colorless ether movements are led through the eye to our brain are they recreated, transformed into Vorstellung, mental images, which we call colors." End quotation. Rotzen continues, "I am convinced of the fact that every person whose thinking is based upon a sound ideation basis and has not been accustomed from the youth onwards to be introduced to such a spring of thoughts, such a batch of thoughts, such person would in fact find the proposition absolutely absurd. The situation has still another dubious side. If in the real world in the main there does not exist anything else but vibrating atoms, oscillating atoms, then there cannot be any real objective ideas. Because whenever I grasp an idea, take hold of an idea, so I can ask myself, what is the significance of this idea external to my consciousness? Nothing further than an oscillation of the molecules of my brain. Because my molecules of my brain in this moment oscillate in such and such a way, my brain, Gaukeld, gives me the illusion or the delusion of an idea. So that every reality in the world is merely condensed into movement, and all the rest is just mere vaporization, the result of this movement. If this way of thinking was the correct way, then I have to say to myself, man, the human being, is nothing further than a mass of oscillating molecules. That is the only reality as far as he's concerned. If I have a great idea and I follow this idea to its origin, so I will arrive at this or that movement. If I want to perform a good action, this I can only do if my brain prefers to have a particular mass of molecules and to carry out a certain definite motion. Now, under such circumstances, I'd like to ask the question, under such presuppositions, can the values good or bad have still any value? I can merely only bring forward what results out of the movements of the molecules of my brain. And out as a result of all these reasons, we can say that the pessimism of Della Grazie had proceeded. She says, what is all this Gaukelwelt, this illusionary world of ideas and ideals, if it is nothing other than movement of atoms? And she believed very well on the correctness of present-day natural science. Because she could not lift herself up above this sort of approach, And she couldn't behave like normal people who are indifferent to such logical thinking. She couldn't remove herself from this comfortless position, and hence she fell into a severe pessimism. Now, the error at the base of these conclusions of natural science is so simple that actually we really can't understand how the whole intellectual world of the present time could have fallen into this most ridiculous error. We can make it clear to ourselves by a simple example. Let's say, for example, someone in place A, from place A, he sends me a telegram. When the telegram is brought to me, I have nothing in front of me other than a piece of paper with signs written on the paper. Insofar as I confront these things, and as long as I can read the signs on the paper, I can actually, essentially learn more than what is written just upon the paper and signs upon the paper. Because I can learn to understand them, that what's written on the paper, the signs, have for me a quite definite thought content. Can I now say that I have just produced this thought content in my brain? And the only single reality is only paper and signs on the paper? Most certainly not. Because the content which I now have in me is exactly the same content which was contained in place A. This example is the most apt and appropriate example to which one can choose. Because in a visible way, not the smallest thing visibly has arrived to me from A. Who's going to maintain that the wires of the telegraph actually carry thoughts from one place to another? The situation is exactly the same with our sense perception. If a series of small ether particles which oscillate back and forth 589 times in a second pinch upon my eye, and these stimulate the sight nerve, so to be sure there appears to me this, for example, the sensation of green. But the ether waves are very similar to what I've just mentioned above, the telegram paper with the signs of the paper. They are only the carriers of the green. And the green actually exists on the body. You can't call the mediator of the green the reality of the situation. So, as in the case of the telegram, whereas in the case of the telegram, the mediator is electricity and wire, so here the mediator is the swinging, oscillating ether. And so, because the green is only mediated through the swinging ether, you cannot say that the green is just the same as the oscillating ether. The oscillating ether is the medium through which the reality of green can be transmitted. This crude confusion and interchange between the mediator and the content which is being mediated, this lies at the basis of the whole modern natural science. We must assume that the green is a property of the body. This green stimulates an oscillating motion of 588 billion oscillations in a second. This oscillating motion impinges on the sight nerve, and this sight nerve is so instituted, so organizes, that it knows that when 589 billion oscillations arrive at, then can only proceed from a green surface. In a similar way, likewise, it is the situation with all our other Vorstellungen, other mental images, mental concepts. If I have a definite thought, a definite idea, or a definite ideal, so must this naturally also be present in a real way in my brain. This is only so possible that the brain parts in a definite way move themselves, because a being expanded in space can suffer no other changes than movement. If you have something in space, the only changes it can experience, as far as space is concerned, is a change in movement. But it would be a very bad confusion of the content of the idea and the way in which the idea appears in the body if one wanted to say that the movement itself is the idea. Not at all. The movement offers the possibility that the idea can win configuration, form, spatial existence. However, we are still able to take hold of the situation from quite another side. There exists for the human being in the main nothing with which we are so completely present as we are present in our ideas, ideals, and our mental images. We live in them and we weave in them. If we are in complete dark, in a complete soundless situation where we do not have any sense impressions, what is it of which we are there completely and fully conscious? Namely, our thoughts and ideas. After these, there then come everything which I can perceive through the senses. Whenever my sense organs open themselves to the external world and are receiving for it. Besides ideas, besides ideals, and besides sense impressions, nothing else is given to me. Everything else could only be erschlossen, can only be inferred as existence on the basis of sense impressions and ideas. The question is, am I permitted to make such an assumption in reference with moving atoms? Whenever movement occurs, so there must be something there which actually moves. How do I know of the existence of movement? Only through the fact that I see that the bodies change their place within space. What, however, there moves in front of me, they are bodies with all qualities of color, etc. Now, what is it that the physicist wants to explain? Let us say the color. He says the color is movement. Now, what moves itself? A colorless body. Or he wants to explain heat. He says this is movement, etc. What moves itself? A body without warmth. In short, if we explain all the properties of the body through movement, so ultimately we must assume that that which is movement has no qualities at all, since all qualities arise only first out of movement. So now we can recapitulate. The physicist explains all the perceptive senses, all the qualities which the senses perceive. The physicist explains that through movement. What moves itself can, with that, have no qualities. However, which has no qualities, can that which hasn't any qualities, cannot in the main move. So consequently, the atom that which the physicists want to assume is a thing which, when it is sharply evaluated, flows away into nothingness. And with that, the whole method of explanation disappears. We must attribute, ascribe an objective existence to colors, as well as warmth, as well as tones, as well as movement. And with that, we have refuted the physicists and have proven the objective reality of the world of phenomena and ideas. And here ends the thesis. Certainly now I come to the end of the thing, and there's a note by the publishers to this particular thesis. And he says, with the Niederschrift, with the writing down, now I come to the end of the thing, and there's a note by the publishers to this particular thesis. And he says, with the Niederschrift, with the writing down of this thesis, there's an obvious mistake. Obviously, water consists chemically out of two parts of hydrogen and one part of oxygen. Next comment is that the citation in the manuscript on page 4 is taken from Hugo Magnus's Color and Creation, eight lectures about the relationship of colors to man and nature, Breslau, 1881, cite page 161. The exact quotation is, this ether movement is a single aspect which is the reality of the color, and is objectively present in creation. Only in the human body, in the brain, do these ether movements are form themselves to Vorstellungung, which we indicate ordinarily as red, green, yellow. We must accordingly say that creation in itself is absolutely colorless. Only through these colorless ether movements through the eye, led to our ear, are we transform those to Vorstellung, which we indicate as color. And to the indication on the pessimism of Del Grazzi, see Rudolf Steiner's book, The Story of My Life. Wait, I have to have a comment on the comment made by the publisher when he says it's a mistake in the recording. I don't think so, because I think I have to disagree with them, because actually it's not a mistake in the writing, because actually here they do publish the actual diagrams, and in the diagrams themselves, Rudolf Steiner, instead of putting two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen and surrounding those by a larger circle, he definitely puts in just one atom of hydrogen, one of oxygen. He does do it definitely. So it's not a mistake in writing down. It's just a sudden block Rudolf Steiner must have had. He must have had a mental block that cut himself off. He knew very well that water consists of two atoms of hydrogen, one of oxygen. In the actual Fig 3, which Rudolf Steiner himself drew, because we have it in his own... Because incidentally, in this particular publication, it puts in printing, it also puts in Rudolf Steiner's own handwriting. So we see this in Rudolf Steiner's own handwriting, and also we see it in the actual diagrams he drew. He drew 20 circles containing just one atom of hydrogen and one of oxygen. So it's not a question of recording, It's a question of a mental block Rudolf Steiner had at that time. Because actually his thesis doesn't rise and fall whether there are two atoms of hydrogen to one of oxygen or whether one atom of hydrogen to one of oxygen makes water. It's merely independent of his thesis, of course. So we have to recognize that Rudolf Steiner did make mistakes. Here's a question of an obvious mistake. Also, we must again in this connection recognize that Rudolf Steiner himself did learn as he grew. For example, in the early stages of his publications, he spoke about Lemuria being millions and millions of years away. But later on, towards the end of his life, he clearly stated that Lemuria goes back only perhaps about 30,000 years, no more. In fact, he puts the last period of the Lemurian epoch about 30,000 years ago. In fact, Wachsmuth puts this latest idea of Rudolf Steiner in his publications. Rudolf Steiner did learn, just as he only learned after the beginning of the 20th century the fact of that evolution was not evolution, but there was a devolution. That the apes descended from man, and man did not descend did not evolve from the apes. He learned that later on too. After he was about 30, 40 years old. His other point, Rudolf Steiner, more than one occasion clearly mentioned the fact that if ever mankind went to the moon, you'd find nothing physical there. Now, by recognizing all these facts, it doesn't detract from the genius of Rudolf Steiner and from the significance that he has, not at all. But it does help to put us in correct perspective and prevents us falling into a fanaticism. Continue with this publication. Now, this publication presents an extract of a lecture held in Leipzig in which he says something like this, Leipzig, 11th of June, 1917. And that's Schmidt number 3381. This is the quotation. It's now 1917, either 35 to 36 years since I attempted to present the first germinal aspects of that which today I call spiritual science. That time, as I wrote down the first thoughts about this world conception, there fell into my hands a thesis of the great, significant aestheticist and philosopher Friedrich Theodor Fischer, what one calls the V. Fischer. This thesis occupied itself with the extraordinarily interesting work by the Leipzig philosopher Johannes Falkelt with his book entitled The Dream Fantasy, Stuttgart, 1875. In this thesis of Fischer's, there exists a very remarkable sentence by which at that time I had to remain standing, in which I had to engage myself, I might say, with all my striving. I had already engaged myself in the main, and hence I had to remain standing with this sentence. It is a remarkable sentence which Fischer there wrote down. The sentence was, the unity of the soul life can most certainly not be localized within the body, although it can nowhere else other than in the body make itself existence, make itself come to appearance. Now, this is a completely paradoxical sentence. There, someone says, that which is the unitary soul cannot be in the body, but it also cannot be outside the human body. Here we have a complete contradiction, and nevertheless a contradiction to which a certain human thinking must come, not through an arbitrariness, but through an unconditioned inner necessity. And one cannot only arrive at one such contradictions, but one can arrive at hundreds of such contradiction to which ordinary thinking and ordinary scientific thinking must arrive at. When these come at such a contradiction, what do? They remain standing as if before a border of the human capacity of cognition. And they say to themselves, the human being has a definite capacity of cognition, and this leads him to borders, and these limits he can't strive over. Already at that time, out of the first germinal aspects which yielded themselves for me for what I call here spiritual science or anthroposophy, out of these first germinal aspects, I had to say to myself, there is another relationship to these border questions than that which is commonly taken. That if you want to found a real soul science and a real spiritual science, you have to take a different relationship to the so-called border questions. And at that time I wrote the thoughts which I had precisely in attachment to this sentence of Fisher. I wrote to Fisher, who in a very extraordinary receptive way answered me that in actual fact, that the way in which I wrote to him in my thesis which I sent him, that in this thesis there does open itself the knowledge of the spiritual life. So I had the belief that such a person as Friedrich Theodor Fischer, who still stood within the traditions of the first half of the 19th century, actually, out of their science and philosophy, they would have been able to find a connection to spiritual science. Whereas most other scientists find it very difficult, and all they can do is have opposition and with their ordinary consciousness against spiritual science. But unfortunately, to be sure, Fisher died soon after he wrote me that. And so what in my writings and lectures have been presented as anthroposophical spiritual science, that had to arise without his assistance and help. Now, the third extract in this little booklet dealing with Rudolf Steiner's relationship to atomism is entitled The True Origin of Atomism, and it's an extract from the lecture in Dornach of the 16th of October 1915, which is a third lecture in Rudolf Steiner's book The Occult Movement in the 19th Century and Its Relationship to World Culture. Now, since this book has been published, there's no reason for me to translate this article. You have it in the book itself. Then there's another extract from Rudolf Steiner's book, The Story of My Life, chapter 32. It's a very small extract. Since it's small, I might as well just translate it here, because it does help, it fits in more. As far as I'm quoting now from chapter 32, as far as I am concerned, less for me about the fact of atoms to be assumed in as a pure mechanical or some sort of activity within material happenings. It was far more important for me to proceed from the thinking consideration of the atomistan, of the atomistic, of the smallest world structures, and to proceed from the thinking contemplation of the atomistic aspect and finding the transition over to the organic, to the spiritual. I saw the necessity there of proceeding from the totality. Atoms or atomic structures could only be the results of spirit workings, could only be the results of organic workings. I wanted to start off from the perceived primal phenomenon, not from a thought construction. I want to do this in the spirit of Goethe's nature contemplation. It was very deeply convincing for me was what there existed in Goethe's words, that the the factual aspect is already theory in front of you, that you shouldn't try to look behind it. However, that conditions the fact that you have to take what nature offers you, what the senses give you, and what the thinking on this domain only utilizes itself to be able to proceed from the complicated derived phenomena which do not permit themselves to be surveyed, to proceed from these complicated phenomena to the more simple primal phenomenon. There one notices that in nature one is concerned indeed with colors and other sense qualities within which the spirit is active. One does not arrive at an atomistic world behind the sense aspect. That which as atomism has validity, that belongs to the sense world. And here ends the extract. Now we have the summary of all this, and written by the publisher of this manuscript, of this article, of this publication. Thesis entitled The Single Possible Criticism of Atomistic Concepts, the 20-year-old student Rudolf Steiner sent to the philosopher and aestheticist Friedrich Theodor Fischer. In many lectures of the year 1917, as well as still again in the 1923 published introduction to the new edition of the book Fundamentals of a Theory of Cognition of Goethe's World Conception with Special Consideration of Schiller, Rudolf Steiner had pointed out the significance of this youthful work and pointed to his inner connection to Friedrich Theodor Fischer. So he characterized the thesis in a lecture held in Stuttgart on the 12th of May 1917 as the first beginning of that which I might indicate as spiritual science, which I designate as spiritual science. This lecture, the 12th of May 1917, has the Schmidt number of 3367. Manuscript, which for a long time was considered to be lost, was found again in 1939 by the Tübingen Tübingen University Library, and it appeared in the same year in the Wochenschrift Das Goetheanum. They found this manuscript in the estate of Friedrich Theodor Fischer. Put blue lines under this manuscript, on certain points of this manuscript. He underlined certain parts of it. Manuscript of the 23rd of September 1819. The atomistic and its refutation was discovered in 1935 in a Viennese estate. Both of these theses serve the proof that the construction of a world of atoms as the fundamental basis of all natural phenomena is from the epistemological viewpoint, and you can't maintain it from can be refuted epistemologically. In the act of cognition, so Rudolf Steiner already made himself validated in his thesis of 1882, in the act of cognition, there must be the external experience of sense perception and the inner activity of thinking must complete each other mutually. To the atom, there actually sense qualities are attributed to the atom. At the same time, however, there is an existence ascribed to it which is inaccessible to sense experience. If the atoms are supposed to find themselves in continuous motion, so further with that, the existence of an absolute space and one something, Nachainanda, something going off, one proceeding one after the other, which means an absolute time, is presupposed. You must presuppose the existence of an absolute space and an absolute time if the atoms are supposed to be in continuous motion. However, an absolute space there cannot exist an absolute space if you disregard the objects of the sense world. Likewise, is time for our consciousness only given with and in connection with the processes of the sense world. In this connection, Rudolf Steiner speaks of a great number of false concepts which have current existence through the incorrect concepts of time and space. There have resulted a great number of false ideas. At that time, he had already arrived at the knowledge of the double stream of time, which represents a central element of his spiritual science. Please see Heller Wiesberger's article on Rudolf Steiner's life work in its reality, published in the Beitrager, numbers 49 to 50, Easter 1975. To the first, as well as especially to the later thesis of 1890, naturally you have to say that the ideas upon which the atomistic at that time were built up have since then completely and fundamentally changed. What was deduced from that as a mechanistic, materialistic world picture has experienced, however, no change at all. Even though the change in the concept of the atom has changed since Rudolf Steiner wrote it, people still consider it as part of a mechanistic, materialistic world picture. And in reference to this world picture, there is still unchanged what Rudolf Steiner spoke in his article of the lack of comfort of a scientific way of representing things, in which ideas and ideals were supposed to possess no real essential value. Now the question is, however, the nature of the atom in the main possible to be grasped in a phenomenological way? In this connection, Rudolf Steiner enters into it in the introductory lecture of the cycle held in Stuttgart from 23rd of December 1919 to the 3rd of January 1920 under the title of the first natural scientific course, GA320. Further, in the same volume, in the connection with the question and answer, you have there the statement that atoms are to be regarded as having an ideal space content. The content are the results of the working of forces as they meet each other. Rudolf Steiner does not speak get the atom in the physics is in Rudolf Steiner doesn't oppose the fact of the use of atom in physics as a working hypothesis. In the lecture of the 6th of October 1915, contained in the cycle The Occult Movement of the 19th Century, GA 254, this hypothesis is valid as an abbreviatur, as a Rechenmunzer, as a coin for calculation. The fact that in development the horrible world structure of materialism appeared Rudolf Steiner indicated as a necessity. At the same time, he goes into the question how it was possible for the human being to conceive of a world of atoms. He projected in an occult physiological sense his inner experience of his own nerve endings into space. In reference to its fundamental significance, we repeat again the exposition of Rudolf Steiner following his second thesis on atomism and how it's refuted. It also has to be mentioned that he gave another occult aspect of the atom system in a great connection in the lecture of Berlin on 7th of August 1917. This is Schmidt number 3393, and you'll find it in SL 266. Rudolf Steiner's spiritual perception had yielded itself to him the frightful danger which grows out of the fact that destructive spiritual forces are responsible for inventions, premature inventions, for which the human being can have applied, but for whom human being have not yet morally advanced enough to have those inventions. These dark forces want to prepare the Earth mission towards a premature destruction of the planet. In an open way, Rudolf Steiner had indicated the destructive potential of atomic physics, and you'll find that in the lecture of the 1st of October 1911 entitled The Etherization of the Blood. Now shortly we want to point to the fact that the primeval atom, the primal atom, as it was depicted in the third and fourth lecture of the cycle Egyptian Myths and Mysteries, had nothing whatsoever to do with the assumption of a substance of a material formation. It represents the ideal picture of the future man, which placed itself before the clairvoyant perception of the Atlantic initiate. Rudolf Steiner, in his story of his life, chapter 32, calls it a distortion of thinking, which is represented by the Hubi Schleiden theosophical theory, according to which primal substances, primal parts of the world's substance, are supposed to group themselves around to atoms and molecules. In the last of the articles, you have the final citation in which, in confrontation with the speculation of the game in which is played with atomismus, Rudolf Steiner confronts that with a nature knowledge which proceeds starting from the perception of the primal phenomenon, find its transition through the organic to the spiritual. And here ends this total series of extracts.